Hey, it's Francis Lamb, host of The Splendid Table. Every week on our show, we talk about food and cooking and the meanings of food and cooking. We talk with the most interesting people in food about their techniques, their culture, and everything in between. Whether it's about how fried chicken took over the world or how Instagram changes the way people are actually eating. It's a food show where everyone is welcome. Come join us. You can listen to The Splendid Table wherever you get your podcasts.
You're listening to Heritage Radio Network.
Welcome to the Grape Nation, your weekly wine journey. Our guest is Luis Ciabra. We'll talk to Luis about the Douro, Douro, Vino Verde, all his wines and more. Luis brought a wine that we're going to taste. We'll tell you about it later. I'm your host, Sam Ben Ruby. Stay with us for the Grape Nation on the Heritage Radio Network. We bring wine to the people. Luis Ciabra actually lived in Angola when he was a young kid, but he returned to Portugal in the 70s. He studied viticulture at Villarreal, and his obsession with terroir led him to work in soil research in Vino Verde. He launched a revolutionary still wine program while working at Nearport. Eventually starting his own small winery in 2013, Luis Ciabra Vinos. To Luis, it's all about making wines he enjoys drinking, elegant, fresh, terroir-driven wines that are also age-worthy. Luis Ciabra is the most exciting winemaker in Portugal today, at least in my opinion. All right? So you got to accept that.
Thank you, Sam.
Welcome to the Grape Nation, Luis. So I'm talking to Luis live in New York City. Luis, why are you in New York?
I have a tasting of my importer, so I'm going to do not. I'm today in New York, but then I'm going to travel through different states.
And so that's what I want to ask you.
Presentation of my wines all over. So they do.
How many?
It's kind of a primer. I do three states, three different towns. I'll back home on Friday.
Okay. While you're here, you might as well see as many people as you can. Luis, as I mentioned to you earlier, you have a pretty interesting life. Portugal to Angola, be very young, back to Portugal, studying wine and eventually making wine in three regions. Give me a little background on your journey in life and wine. The first thing I'm curious about is what was that moment, time, or thing that you realized wine is something I wanted to do? Because I guess from that point on, you pursued it at different levels. So give me a chronology.
Well, one thing you have to understand is in Portugal, everyone is related to wine somehow.
Okay.
So you ever familiar, someone in the family that have a vineyard, or have, my grandfather had a vineyard in the Douro Valley. Not that I had a connection with my grandfather because of the vineyards. I was a kid. I didn't know anything about the wines and vineyards. And I was just going, you know, up north to visit my grandfather.
So wait, that was your grandfather. Your parents had nothing
my
to do with
it. Nothing like that. It was my grandfather, and I remember to see at a very young age, when we came from Angola, used to live near Lisbon in Cascais, small nice village by the sea.
Right.
And you know, before the garage, for the parking the cars, we had a vineyard, as a pergola. Not for production purpose. It's just you know give some shadow. And the interesting thing was that vineyard never gave any grapes.
I didn't.
Of course, it was no badly good. Treated. Obvious. My father was not for pruning vineyards, that's for sure.
That's funny.
And one day, my grandfather visited us, and he pruned the vineyards.
Ah.
And that year, I saw, you cannot imagine how many grapes I saw it like never before. And this was one magic moment that I was, this is really interesting, you know. My grandfather came here, he just pruned. And suddenly we are full of grapes, you know. That's nice. But I was a very young kid, so not...
But it caught your attention.
Called my attention then, but, you know, passed by. I think I started in the wine... Well, first, because when I had to decide what to study, I know I didn't want to go to any office. Nowadays, I'm always with my computer around, but unfortunately, but I didn't want to stay close anywhere. I wanted to go, you know, open fields outside, not
inside.
You
weren't a corporate guy.
No, that's for sure. Yeah. And I started to study viticulture, but my connection with wine was at the young age. I remember I'm coming from a big family. We are six in total, six in between brother and sister, so four boys, two girls. And I remember the Sunday lunch with my father, and my father would spend a lot of time to choose the right bottle, decant the bottle to serve the wine.
So he was into having a nice bottle.
He was.
That was part of the tradition of a meal in
exactly.
the family.
Exactly. Okay. Was in the,
so you grew up around wine.
So the wine came into my life much more on the consumption side, on the social aspect of the wine, on as how people take care of a product. It's just wine. At that age, I would be drinking water and eating. So for me, it was kind of interesting to see how much time can you spend with a drink that you're going to do it with your meal. So that was probably the main reason.
Wow. So you study... You, like I mentioned in the intro, you have this little obsession with soil, terroir. You study.
I studied viticulture. So
viticulture, like, but then
yeah.
you went to Vino Verde to study soil. Tell me how that worked.
More than soil, I was studying the combination between soil and rootstock.
Ah.
So actually, it was an investigation process. So when I finished university, in between many different things. I teach university also, but I went to something in the Portuguese government, agriculture minister, to do investigation. And the investigation process that I was leading was something in between the soils and rootstock. So how the rootstock adapts to the soil with a certain varietal. It was a very interesting study. Gave me, I don't know if it gave me a lot of knowledge, but gave me the perception of how different things can be if you put the right rootstock in the right variety in the right place, and how wrong they can be if you do it the wrong way.
But that's true anywhere, right?
Yeah.
You were specifically looking at the soils of that area and the grapes, mostly the indigenous probably or whatever, maybe you were experimenting. What were some of the conclusions that were interesting?
Well, one conclusion that I realized then, long time ago, it's the rootstock that was being used by far in the region was not the best rootstock. You know, many times the growers just want to have the one that give you the prettier vineyard, and the prettier vineyard doesn't give necessarily the best wine.
So can you go backwards? This is where your expertise is. When you talk about rootstock, you're talking about the root and, I guess, you know, the trunk. Are you cloning things to the rootstock, or rootstock is, you know, the grape? Healthy rootstock with proper, you know, cloning will give you, you know, a vineyard of healthy. Is that what we're talking
about? Well, as you know, phylloxera was a big problem in Europe. Right. Destroy all the vineyards.
In Portugal, too?
In Portugal, too. Okay. All over, you know, the whole world. And suddenly you had to, you know, to graft all the vineyards with American rootstock resistant to phylloxera.
Right.
Suddenly rootstock becomes something very important, and choose the right rootstock become, you know.
So with the right rootstock, and I may be repetitive, once you have that right, once you start the grafting, you're less prone to disease because you chose the rootstock that, you know, will...
Yeah, the reason for the rootstock, it was just to avoid phylloxera that destroyed all the vineyards.
What was it? Was it American rootstock or European?
It was American rootstock.
It was.
The only that was resistant, actually. Okay. Phylloxera came from America and the rootstock afterwards also.
Yeah, right. And when was this, like in the 80s,
70s? Beginning of... end of 19th century, beginning of the... 20th century.
Okay.
And many vineyards were devastated. But the interesting thing is, then suddenly, and now to the point that we keep on studying until today, everything was new. We need to know what is the best rootstock in different places because there are different plants. So that study need to be done. And I remember that I've studied for the agriculture ministry that they didn't do many tastings or winemaking. So I remember to arrive there, and everyone was doing investigation, you know, kilos, sugar levels, acidity, you know, measuring everything in the vineyard, but then there was no final wine.
Well, yeah.
I mean, and then I realized, well, what about if you vinified and we taste the final wine to see the result? Oh, do you think we need to do that? Of course we need to do that.
So it was literally rootstock study with no final grape product to vinify.
But that's for me, that's a problem. It, still to today, it's viticulture is separate from winemaking and shouldn't be. Because many times the viticulture investigation never finish in the final wine.
Right. How do you know what the benefits of what you did is?
Exactly.
Right.
Also because it's very subjective. So if you get together three people around a bottle of wine, around the wine that is a result of investigation, they may have different opinions. It's very difficult,
sure,
especially if you're not prepared to do the final tasting. But for me, this is the main thing. So it was interesting to see people that never taste wines before and trying to do a panel for tasting the result of the experiment.
Do you think other countries and governments were doing similar stuff?
Oh, yeah. Well, all over Europe, actually.
All
kind of research, yes.
Nobody was sharing anything, were they, or a little?
No. You can share whatever you want, but if you don't have the exact soil and the exact varietals.
Right.
You know the procedures, you know how to do the investigation.
Right, the process.
But you can never get the same results,
right,
anyway.
All right, so you did that. At some point after that, do you go to, am I pronouncing it right, Nearport?
Yeah, so in between many things I've done before, so when I was studying university and immediately after, I teach in university, you know, the people that were just arriving in those first year classes. I work for the government investigation. Then I work in a cooperative, big cooperative in the Vigneverde area. Not doing the best wines ever, but very good for you to learn about logistics.
But cooperatives aren't necessarily negative. I mean, Produttori di Barbaresco.
They are not, unfortunately, in Portugal.
Alto Adige, you know, terrific stuff.
There are a few.
But these guys, they didn't care about quality.
I think you can count with a hand the good producers,
yeah,
you know?
I guess so.
Produttori di Barbaresco, Chablisien, yeah, and not much more.
Yeah.
But anyway, it was...
Were you aware of that? Did that frustrate you?
A little bit, but was also beginning of everything. So
right, you knew as much
everything
as you
was
knew.
New for me. So that was interesting. Then I went to the opposite side. So I went to a consulting company, doing consultancy in winemaking and viticulture to very small growers that didn't have any condition. So I learned the other side: how to do wines with no conditions, how to improvise, you know, how to find solutions for problems that you would never imagine you would find. And that was another interesting period of my life where I learned a lot, although it was also desperately because, you know, sometimes you're doing wines with no conditions and,
right,
you know, you do the best you can. It was also a very good school. And only after that, I went to Nieuport, working at Nieuport for several years.
Was Dirk there or was it
yeah,
the
was
family?
Dirk. Was Dirk there. Well, Dirk
he was like the next generation.
He was already ahead of the company. Yeah.
Was that an interesting opportunity?
It was...
You worked with them and developed still wines, right?
Yeah, they were already producing the still
wines.
They were. There was a winemaker before. The first winemaker was the one that preceded me, before me. I got into a stage that Nieuport was already focusing on dry wines, on table wines, but growing a lot. So from the moment I got in and got out, the company grew a lot in volume and in
producing
the wines. But it was interesting times because everything was new in Douro. Douro was kind of booming. You know, it was late 90s scores, high scores in Portugal. That was the main region with recognition outside of Portugal. Because
so when you say everything was growing, and we're going years back, like you mentioned, is everyone mostly growing grapes for port? And that's when, you know, the other wines really started growing at that. Was that really the early stage of that?
Douro was the region created by the port industry.
Right.
You know, British, not
Ship
only the British
everything
houses.
Down the river.
Everything down to the, everything
right.
down to Vila Nova de Gaia. Aging was more important than the vinification because vinifying a port wine, it's more or less the same thing. You cannot You cannot change much on the vinification of the ports. You cannot invent much. But it's true that the most famous wine in Portugal, Barca Velha, is from the 50s. So that was the first dry wine that got attention of everyone. Then lately, in the 80s, there were a few brands on the more western part of the Douro that had recognition in Portugal, and they sold and were good brands created mostly by a distributor that got attention to those wines. And then suddenly that dropped down. Those wines went down somehow. And then what we see, it's middle, late 90s,
is
first growers appearing, doing interesting things, growing a lot, and then the boom on the late 90s, early 2000s, with a lot of producers arriving.
It's so crazy how not long ago that was, right?
Exactly.
I mean,
it's really
a young thing. Let's finish the chronology timeline. Do you go from Nearport to starting your own winery, which was around 2013?
2013. I left Nearport in December 2012 to start my own project.
So was that like a big leap? Were you ready? I mean, did you have an idea of what you wanted to do? Because it's very specific what you're doing now.
Well, I only done wines in my... So my life is very simple and maybe boring for some people. I'm always around wines, wines and vineyards.
The most gorgeous wines that you make, and in Burgundy, you're farmers. You're home in the fields. So.
Exactly. That's the
thing.
That's
how it works.
That was life for me. I think I was ready even before that. And it was just, you know, taking the decision of the moment when to do it. But I think I had...
So what was the vision? Did you know what type of wines you wanted to make? Did you know where? I mean, was it the Douro? Because most of the wines you make now still are from the Douro.
Yes, it's difficult to explain, but I think what is important, I have an idea of the style of the wines I like to drink, so that will be the wines I like to do it.
That's always been your theme.
That's always been my thing, but it's the vineyard that tells you what wine you can do it, and not the other way around. And I think many times...
But you knew that.
People don't realize. But many times even, I think, wine growers, wine producers, they don't realize that you can do the wine that the vineyards allows you to do. So the decision of making the wine is to find the right vineyard.
Right.
So
the vineyard speak.
Exactly. The big work was to find the vineyards that I would like to work with. And that is the main thing. After that, the vinification is kind of a simple process.
Right. If you come in with good grapes.
Yeah.
So you're getting to a point that I want to talk a little more about. Portugal's been making some great wines, you know, for a while. And this sounds, you know, not right, but Portugal's really starting to get the attention it deserves. Should have gotten it earlier is my point. But it's really starting to get the attention. And I think you were very much a part of that. You know, I think people have said you're the leader of the new Portugal Renaissance. You know, take it or not, it's been spoken that way and all of that. I'm curious about two things. What is that Renaissance? Was that what you were alluding to, like in the 90s or since then? And, you know, has there been a cultural shift in Portuguese winemaking? You know, you were in the thick of that. So just take that any way you want and respond to that.
Well, one thing is there's many more people doing good wines in Portugal.
Not and saying maybe they're not,
yeah,
but
and
I'm singling you out specifically.
Exactly. No, well, that's the vision that in some places people have. But it was more than that. Portugal spent different phases of the wine production. Portugal produces and sells wine for centuries.
Right.
It's a wine country, you know. It's probably the old world country that have more vineyard area for surface of the country, I would say. And passing different phases, we have great wines from whites and reds, from different regions, from the 30s, from the 40s. But at the same time, we had a lot, like not only us, the world would have more faulty wines. And
right.
And then in the early 90s, late 80s, early 90s, a lot of winemakers studying in university arrived to the industry, and they changed the industry.
In
some cases for better, in some cases for worse. So all the wines became less faulty. All the wines became more drinkable. But maybe they done wines that were more similar in between each other. So technique was overpowering the place.
The vineyard. The grape.
The area, what the French call the terroir. The
combination
of everything.
I
think they improved many things.
Right.
Because, you know, hygiene in the winery, they introduced a lot of winemaking products that maybe I'm not 100% agreeing with that. But, you know, they made the wines at a very good standard, but very similar. In that process, we lost the magic of those unique wines that are, you know, maybe you don't have many, but the ones that wake you when you smell the glass, when you drink it, oh, this is a different story. And maybe we lost a little bit of that, especially also it was the late 90s. Fashion was, you know, scores, points on the wines.
Right, that influenced what type of wine you made,
exactly.
Right? Yeah.
So was the production influencing more than the place?
So it was a bunch of university guys who came back with technique and ideas.
And that happened not only in
right.
Portugal, that
right.
happened all over the old world.
So is the shift either culturally or the Renaissance recognizing that and getting back to, you know, letting the terroir and the grapes express themselves?
I think in most of things in life, we have to go a little bit too far to come back to the right place. And I think people realize that. So suddenly they realize, oh, maybe people are giving attention to the wines that express a place. That is, you know, it's the perfect wine doesn't exist. Like there's no perfect person. The edges and the combination between the different edges make the perfect balance in between a wine and a person and everything. So people realize that wine is way much more than what you do in the winery. Suddenly, it's the vineyard. And suddenly, in many cases, you in the winery, you make too much effort that you don't need to do it.
Right.
Your effort, it's covering what the wine can give. So many times you realize that with age and with experience, that less effort let the wine speaks for itself.
That's been a mantra for a while.
And this is... It's not. I don't think this is only in wine. I think it's again in life,
food, it's farming,
everything.
You know,
when you set back and you more observing than doing it, that is also important. You know, you realize
right.
that with less effort you can do better.
I'm curious because I've been to the Douro, and you know, visited wineries, the hills down to the river. A lot of it are the port manufacturers. Was there a bias towards the smaller winemakers that were not either growing for port or making port?
Well, you have to understand that this happened, and more today when the consumption of port wine, it's not growing. You know,
it kind of hit its plateau.
45 wines, 20% alcohols and sugar, it's maybe not the wine that is in fashion. So in the beginning, some of the port houses... went straight to the still wines, and the ones that they didn't went then, they are doing it now. So
right.
everyone is on the still wines production.
Right, that's an interesting transformation. When you make wines, when you started the winery, and even today, are there any regions, winemakers, wines that you taste or know about how they do things that influence what you do? I mean, I'm sure you got a bunch of wine buddies from around the country.
The country and the world.
Right.
And what
But do you look towards someone and say, you know, that?
And it's more than that. I think one thing that I still try to do, it's visit many different wine regions and different wine producers. And I learn with all of them. But one thing that is important that I tend to say that to all younger people that arise is when you go out and what you see is not what you're going to do when you arrive to your own place. What you see outside just make you understand better your own place.
Right. That's a fair way to put it.
When you are. So I have plenty.
Don't do what they do. Understand what they did.
Why they did.
Right. And what you need.
But apply to your place. And that, right. that was another thing that happened in viticulture. I think is still happening a little bit. The studies were done in the country that not necessarily apply that to Portugal. So if you study viticulture in Australia, it's not the same thing as doing viticulture in Portugal. Or viticulture in north of France is not the same thing as doing south of Portugal. So you have to adapt to your own place. And in many cases, we didn't. So globalization and university people, they globalize more or less the attitude towards vineyards without thinking where they came from and what are their realities
right.
in comparison to other countries, other wine regions. So I love many wine regions. I love many producers, both in Portugal and outside Portugal, and I learned with many of them. Would be not fair maybe naming all of them.
Right.
I may forget some, but there's a lot of great people doing wines all over the world. And most of the interesting things, it's the passion they put it, but more important than anything, it's how their brain worked to get to a certain place. It's not the destiny that was interesting, it's how they thought about it to get to the destiny.
Right. That's a very interesting point. Because a lot of winemakers I talked to, when they were young, they worked harvests. If they were in a family winery, the family sent them, you know, go work with my friend here and all that. But you're so right about take what you can take from where you were, not copy it or whatever. You know, it's one thing to make great wines in one region. You decided to expand and do it in three regions, and I'll name them the Douro, the Douro, and Vino Verde. I'm sure they all have different challenges and all that. We'll get into that when we talk about the wines, but what compelled you to, you know, further complicate your life?
Is I like just to that I like to complicate my life.
And you the curiosity and the challenge, right?
Yes. Actually, I started only doing the Vinho Verde and the Douro. I started by first variety in Vinho Verde was Alvarinho. Alvarinho is a great varietal. I think not always well treated, and more than people doing right or wrong, I think when I start, there was one way to do the Alvarinho in Portugal, no other way.
Which you didn't necessarily agree with?
What I didn't necessarily agree, but was not bad, but was
right.
only
you
one
You had
style.
Your own.
Yeah. And I think that there's many different options you can use for the production of the Alvarinho. So
right.
the idea was exactly that.
Luis, our wine has arrived. Thank you. So we're going to be tasting in a little bit the Zisto Ilimitado. I thought it was Limitado. It's Ilimitado?
Ilimitado is okay. Unlimited.
Were you making the Vino Verde early on, or you were doing the Douro and then years later? Was that?
No. When we started in 2013, I've done Verde and the Douro at the same time.
Okay. I didn't realize that.
Yeah, from the first moment.
And then when did you start working in the Douro region?
In the Douro region, but to be honest, I know many people are going to listen to our conversation.
Right. And what's going
to
happen?
To be honest, Douro and Bairrada are much more interesting regions to produce dry wines in the Douro Valley. Don't tell anyone.
I'm not, you know, who would know better than you?
Yeah,
I mean, you really get your hands dirty and you realize this is interesting, this is different, this is a challenge. You love that.
Yeah, they are really very unique regions. And years ago, there was a producer, actually a Brazilian friend that arrived to Portugal, wanted to do a wine in the Douro region and wanted me to help start the project. So I started
a Brazilian in Portugal?
In Portugal.
He wanted you in
Brazil? No. Yeah. Brazilian okay. moved to Portugal.
Okay.
Marcelo that do the wines named Teixeira. And that was an opportunity. Oh, that's interesting. But maybe I can also do a wine. And it's interesting. I arrived to Douro to, you know, to help someone else to start a project, but also to doing my own wine. So that was
a
very interesting project.
Perfect. We have to take a quick break, but when we come back, I want to talk about the wines, a little more about the regions, the varietals. There's a big pile of things to talk about.
You can be many hours here.
No, I know, but, you know, we'll focus into them. We're going to take a quick break, but I'm talking to Luis Ciabra from Luis Ciabra Vinos. We'll be right back. You're listening to The Grape Nation on the Heritage Radio Network.
Hey, are you hungry? Well, you're in luck. Meat & 3 is back for season 16. I'm Taylor Early, and we've got a whole new batch of reporters I am so excited to introduce you to.
Hi, I'm Elizabeth Fisher.
Asha McElroy.
Sam Girardi.
Jessica Gingrich.
Hannah from Wisconsin.
I'm a swing dancing audio engineer.
I am a future registered dietitian nutritionist.
I'm from New York, and I love rice and beans.
My favorite food of all time is a shrimp burrito.
I love watermelon.
We've also got a bonus podcast for you called Behind the Internship. Three of our reporters will take you along to show how they develop stories for this very show, Meat and Three.
Hi, I'm Danielle Flitter, a plant-based chef from Philadelphia, living in Mexico City.
I'm Sophia Hooper. I'm a bartender based in Portland, Maine.
My name is Addison Austin Liu. I am a chef and food journalist from Salt Lake City, Utah, and my favorite food is Peruvian.
Rice and beans.
Hand-drawn noodle soup.
So tune in to enjoy a square meal for your ears. And I hope you saved a little room for dessert.
All right, we're back. We're back with my guest, Luis Ciabra. Luis has his own winery. Luis, you make a lot of wines, but not a crazy amount. And I there's method to the madness, and you'll help me organize them. But I want to ask you something first as a backdrop to, you know, getting into the specific wines. You don't put a label on how you farm. I think the label you put is you do common sense agriculture. So this is not the opportunity for me to research and tell people what it is. What is, you know, at this point, you've been doing it for years. You make upwards of a dozen wines. What's the common sense agriculture? Does it include organics or?
Includes, well, what we do.
Treatments.
Includes organic every time that you can do it. And proximity that we have to the vineyards. So I would say the perfect viticulture is not the one I do it, because I cannot be on my vineyards all the time. You know, I'm here, I'm not in the vineyards. The perfect agriculture, I would say, I don't travel anywhere, I'm not going to sell my wines, I'll be there full time. What we do is we do organic farming. The main problem for me in Portugal is the use of herbicides, and if we can avoid that, that will be already a big change. Especially
are
in the
you
Douro
able
Valley.
To? Most of
yes, but it's very, very expensive and costs a lot if you have a very steep slope, and normally you have growers that have 70 years old, and they cannot go with a machine cutting the grass, you know, each month or three times or four times a year. It's a very hard job. So it's difficult. It's very difficult to do it. But I think it's necessary in the Douro. But for instance, this is in the Douro to do organic viticulture. You know, it's easier. In the Vinho Verde area, for me, it's impossible.
But tell me why. I think that's a climate-related
that's
thing,
a
right?
Climate related. It rains
dry
a lot.
Versus...
Yes, it rains a lot in the Vinho Verde area in the north. So treating your vineyards, doing organically. And I know one producer that have one vineyard that does organic. No, I know two of them. And it may happen that one year they don't have any production.
Oh, God.
Also doesn't, you know, for me, it doesn't make sense. And it's kind of, you try to avoid maximum to add anything to the vineyards, outside the vineyards. But sometimes in that region, at least, can be my ignorance. I don't know how to do it.
That's common sense, which is
that's common sense.
The circumstance comes.
Exactly.
And you determine the options.
And this is a big discussion.
Get specific with me. Is that the possible use of some herbicides or just other different
traits? No, herbicides not a problem. There we can easily pass with the tractors to cut. It's milium, the down milium. It's a big pressure in the vigna verde. Any area that rains a lot.
Because of the moisture?
Because we have a lot of rain and with high temperature. It's difficult to control that only with copper.
And only with copper won't work?
Only with copper because you do it copper, you can make some bentonite or some sand you added to absorb humidity in the grapes. But you have a slashing rain and everything is washed out of the berries.
Right.
And you have a limited amount of copper you can add to the vineyard that is also, it's also a heavy metal.
Right.
It's not healthy. Again, it's still a triangle solution. It's not only it's not healthy, that in that region, at least me, I don't know how to control it. And I'm not there 100% of the time, and I don't know how to control it without having to use some chemical products. I would say probably every year round, it was maybe some very dry year, like 17 or something like that, that we could avoid it. I don't know any other way to do it without using these products. I would prefer not to.
Right.
Like you prefer not to have an antibiotic when you're sick.
Right, but some people treat automatically all the time, all year. You know, they're not
circumstantial. The problem is that people do it by rule. Every 2 weeks, they have to treat the vineyards, no matter what the weather or what the weather is going to be. And that's the thing. You have to think before you take an attitude, not, be repetitive without thinking what you're doing.
Or this is something you have to answer from looking outside. I know in other regions that they experience similar problems, and there's been kind of a shift towards, less intervention, copper and all of that. In Portugal, in Vino Verde, are people just lazy, or it's easy to treat, or the farmers are becoming more thoughtful?
It's not that people are lazy. It's you having...
Not lazy, easy, or cost efficient.
Now, the first thing what you have to understand is people that take care of the vineyards, they don't have much knowledge. They didn't study, they never had formation of how to treat the vineyards.
Right.
Then you start to having a gap in generations because it's older people taking care of vineyards. And maybe there are younger people that the most they saw was the older people, how they treated.
Do the younger people recognize it and say, listen, I'm raising kids around here. I don't want, not necessarily.
I don't know.
Really?
It's difficult. But there's a shift in Portugal. There are more and more producers recognizing that they need to change things in the viticulture. And you have more people being aware of that. Also because everyone in the world is aware of that.
But how do people realize? I mean, is there any, organization, government bodies? You have to take the initiative on your own to ask a question. But
you used to have a government bodies.
Not much of that.
Not much anymore.
So you're kind of out there on your own.
And it's not only that. You have a big pressure from the industry. The industry that produced the products that you apply to the vineyards, they repeat all the time, there's no other solution. There's no other solution. That's
they
what
didn't
they
didn't help.
They
didn't help for the better good.
And they have the big power and a lot of money. I think people are starting realizing that, and especially younger generations, seeing through, after the fog, saying, okay, maybe I can do this in a different way.
Right. I think
the future is brighter now.
They're more informed about it. They want to know the story. And they're more conscious, health, environment, soil, which is, a good direction. When you go into the cellar, same practices, right? Low intervention, thoughtful, common sense.
We were discussing when we start is, again, when I think you really get it, it's when you relax, sit back and observe more than you do it, And when you're young, you try a lot to do it well. So you do, you go up and down the vat all the time. You do pump overs. You do, delestage up and down. Do a million different things. Use the most expensive machines. And you really don't need to do that. And when you realize that you don't need to take that much effort because the wine is going to be good or bad anyway. And I think it's that moment when... And I think people nowadays... it's also in fashion to speak low intervention. I can tell you how I do my wines. My wines, I use sulfur. Sometimes in the Douro, we need to acidify, especially the reds. We don't have acidity enough. So I'm already adding something to the wine that is, well, it's coming from the wine, the acidity, but it's extra wine. I don't extract much. And that's it. And then I try not to destroy the grapes that I receive. So in terms of vinification, it's really very simple. And actually, in between the different regions, they are kind of similar because this is the way, in between the different vineyards too, this is the way I have to compare the final result.
That's a good point. All right, so let's talk about the wines. And in talking about the wines, you know, this is where we can talk about varietals. We could talk about climate. We're going to talk about the regions because when we talk about your wines from the Douro, you know, we've talked a little about it, a little about the down Vino Verde, you know, the treatments and all that. So, you know, it's obvious to me, anyone, most of the wines you're making are in the Douro. Tell me about, you know, help me organize this. There's, you pronounce it Zisto, right?
Yeah, Xisto.
Xisto.
Yes.
Xisto. There's the Xisto Cru, Xisto Ilimitado. There's a difference between those two, right? I mean, you have a, with Cru, you have, you know, a mindset of what, tell me about the Cru and the difference.
Well, one thing is if you read all the labels are very focused on the type of soils. So Xisto is the slate that we have in the Douro Valley.
Right.
And granite, like the Granito Cru, it's the granite soil.
Right.
So most of the wines are named after the soil or the mother rock that, you know, produced the soil for the vineyards. That's the first thing. And then when we started only doing the Cru. Cru was a way, was a Cru means the same thing that in French, raw. Right. And the idea was giving the raw, putting the raw soil on the bottle. So the idea was, let's try to do as less as possible. And if you can put the liquid soil in the bottle, we're going to try to do that. And it was also a way to play with the Cru denomination in France because they were specific vineyards. We're talking about one vineyard that gives a goal that we take care of.
So more site-driven than varietal-driven? That's what the Cru mentality or practice is?
Yes, we will go back to that.
Okay.
And then the Ilimitado, unlimited, well, for two reasons too. It's slate in the Douro, it's all over. It's the houses, constructions, it's the soil. you have stones all over. But also unlimited because it's not limited to a specific vineyard. The wine represents a certain area in the Douro Valley. So it would be kind of a village in the French denomination. It's kind of different vineyards, and Ilimitado is negócio, it's grapes that we buy. We don't produce those grapes. So it will be a little bit trying to represent a certain area in the Douro Valley.
Right. So that gives you the leeway to make, you know, to be site specific and to take advantage of all the other great stuff, taking into consideration different soils and all of that. So in the Xisto Ilimitado and the Cru, there's red, white, right?
Yeah.
Tinto.
And Blanco. Yeah.
And Blanco. Let's talk about varietals now. I know that you work with a lot of. Let's talk with the whites, the Blancos first. It looks like you work with a handful of varietals, but I see that Rabigato is predominant as far as all the wines and the percentage in the wines. I don't think a lot of people know about the grape, you know, because that's important to what you do.
It is important, but especially in the States, you have a big focus on the varietal. And for me, and I would say in Portugal in general, it's the combination between varietals and places that makes the difference. And normally, it's much more than one varietal. We are a country of blending, and the blending is already in the vineyard when you plant different varietals, co-planted, that there's no other way besides harvesting everything at the same time. And what you have then...
But that exists in a lot of places. Is that out of necessity, desire, a little of both?
We were a closed country for many years and not without much money. And in some cases, being poor and underdeveloped it helps us to maintain things. So if we talk, for instance, an example, Riesling in Germany, nowadays they have problems that they don't even have clones enough to adapt to the changes of the climate.
Right.
We don't talk about clones. You know, when I work in the agriculture ministry, we would give massal selection to growers. We never discuss a clone, and we never
that
advise.
Explains a lot.
I still don't advise anyone to plant one clone in a vineyard. If you take one variety, at least you plant a massal selection, so different variety of clones to adapt. We done that in Portugal, not with clones, with varietals. So in the Douro, was normal to have a vineyard, and you have one variety that gives.
Is that the healthier, better long-term plan way to do it?
Not necessarily.
Not necessarily,
but. Should we lose that opportunity?
No.
That's the thing. It was always been done like that.
Right.
And it's way much more in an intuition way. And
meaning?
Meaning that when you decide to harvest a vineyard that has so many varieties, you really have to know well the vineyard. You cannot... taking berries and analyzing the samples that give you a certain level of sugar and acidity cannot... guide you to take a decision when to harvest. You really have to go there to taste and to have a general feeling, because you can do
so it's
three or
it's
four.
It's a little less science and a little more feel and understanding, right?
But the winemaking, well, it's a very science-based.
Yeah.
But you have
to feel. Right.
But this is organisms that transform sugar into alcohol that you cannot control 100%.
Right.
And you have to realize, no matter what you do, you can give all the conditions, but you're not going to control 100%. So, for better or worse, you're still in the hands of God, see what's happening. You try your best to give the best solutions, but you don't know what you're going to do. So, in the vineyard, it's more or less the same thing. The opportunity of having, and this is for many reasons. Poor people, if you have a field blend, you have a bigger chance of having even production every year, because they have one variety that produced more in one year, another variety that produced more in another year, meaning that the final wine that we always, here especially, you always want to know exact percentage. When you have a percentage in a co-planted vineyard, is the percentage of plants planted, not grapes amount. Because in one year, you have more one variety. In another year, you have more other variety.
Makes total sense.
But this is that plot. That's why the uniqueness of that plot. That's what it gives you, combined with the year.
So, I don't know. We're still on Gisto.
Yeah.
We're talking Tinto Blanco.
Yeah.
We're talking Cru Limitado. Limitado.
Yeah.
We're talking about... We didn't talk about the reds yet, which are even more varietals. Are you doing a lot of wines, some wines that are field blends? Are you... fermenting them together and not separately?
What I do ferment, it's the vineyard separately. What I try to do it, well, if by some chance logistical you cannot do it, I have to blend different vineyards, but my idea is always I should vinify the vineyard separately.
But that vineyard has multiple varietals.
Having or not.
Okay.
It's my unit is the parcel. It's not the varietal. So what I try to
do
whenever I can is vinified separately, aged separately, blend in the end if you need to blend. Like Xixi Limitado is a blend of multiple vineyards. But I know each vineyard, how behaves year after year. It's for me to know the vineyards.
Right.
So right. I know, you know, I understand better the vineyard if I do it that separately.
Right.
The now, best variety in the white wines, in the Douro, for me the best variety is clearly Rabigat. And this is...
That is a good foundational...
That's a good foundation. And I think this is... This is one example where the combination of the place where Rabigato is planted and the Rabigato is a local variety, this is the great combination. So eventually, if I would have only Rabigato there, I would be a happy man.
Right. But you're managing it. When we move to the reds, the tintos, we're talking about more varietals, right? But in the vein of what we've been talking about, I mean, we're talking, what, 6, 8, 10 different red varietals versus 3, 4, 5 whites? Is that accurate?
Well, just...
You know,
just
so now people, what are we doing there? Is it still field, masa, all that stuff is still there?
You have to realize something. I think Douro Valley authorized varietals. I think they're 146 or 148, something like that.
It's pretty
big. This is what you can plant in the Douro Valley and name the wine as Douro. So you imagine the possible combination.
Crazy.
Well, nowadays people don't plant, don't do co-plantations. They may put the same, different varieties in the same parcel, but they would plant it separately because it helps. It's the modern way and the more logical way to adapt. One thing that I believe, it's the older it gets the vineyard, the less important is the varietal and the more important becomes the place.
So stay with me on this, because this is something I'm familiar that's important to you. Older vines, which is what you're talking about, and you also like altitude, right?
Also, yeah.
So the older vines act differently, or
they give more mature.
Act
wines.
Is not the right word.
I would say that you can feel it in the wine. So when you plant a very young vineyard, when you do the wine of a very young vineyard, when you taste it, you clearly feel the varietal that is there.
All right. So the now we're getting to where
the varietal imposes itself. So you taste, you know, Touriga Franc, whatever variety you planted there, you taste it and, oh, this is this variety. In an old vine, it's more difficult that to happen, even if it is only a single variety.
What are you tasting?
You're tasting more the place. So
the place.
The roots are deeper.
So if it's shale or clary, you're...
The roots are deeper. The wines tend to be less fruity. They tend to be a bit more complex, but not that obvious. While in the, it's also like a person growing, you know?
Right, sure.
You have a young age, they are very intense, and then they got a bit lost when they're teenagers, and then you get an adult person, and, you know, things become more interesting.
I totally get it, but, you know, old vines, you can't make old vines, you know, when you buy
course.
A parcel and, you
no,
know,
you
replant.
Cannot. I would say that a vine starts to get adult, give interesting wines after 10, 15 years.
Is that you're start, comfortable after 10
yeah,
plus 15?
Yeah, and then they start to be really mature after 20 or 25.
But you years. Start after 10, 12, 15 years, you start getting a sense of the place
yes,
you beyond
start
the varietal.
Exactly.
Another thing in the Douro is a mono project.
Yeah.
I think you make mono C.
And mono A.
Both are in the Douro?
No, mono A is in the Douro.
Right. So let's stay in the Douro. Tell me quickly what mono... That's another label.
Yeah, the name came from mono varietal. That's why it named mono.
Okay.
And then you have the C because the first letter of the variety. The variety is Castelão.
Right.
Castelão, it was already the most planted varietal in all Portugal and exists much more in the
a
south.
A while
of the country.
Ago or now?
A while ago.
Okay.
A while ago, not
right.
now. And exists mostly in the south of the country. So it's very known in Setúbal, south of Lisbon, also Alentejo and Lisbon area. That area had a lot of Castelão. And it's a very interesting variety that produces fairly good amount of kilos of grapes per plant, what is very interesting, but not in the Douro Valley, what is even more interesting. And for many years was badly treated because people were trying to do something what Castelão cannot give. And what I tell everyone is don't mind the messenger, it's the message that is wrong.
Right.
Castelão, it's doesn't have much tannins, doesn't have much color. So in the 90s, people were trying to do 15% alcohol dark wines, and the variety was not good for that.
No.
Or they plant the variety in the very fertile soils, and then the variety will produce too much. That also doesn't give interesting wines. So it's not the fault of the varietal. So by accident, I found out this vineyard that is the unique vineyard that I know of Castelão in the Douro Valley. That is not that old. It's kind of 28 years old, something like that.
Good age.
Good
though.
Age, but not that old. But it's the only one. So I'm the only producer that ever produced a single Castelão in the Douro Valley. And you see, being a variety that is not part, it's authorized variety, but you see it a little bit in the old vine,
right.
But you don't see much.
Right.
It's a foreigner there that was perfectly adapted to the place.
That was prominent many, many years ago and now is sort
exactly.
of...
Exactly. And then
it's interesting.
And then you see, and it's...
What are... This is always a hard question to ask. you know, it's a descriptive question. What are the characteristics? I mean, what are you seeing color-wise? Because I think a lot of my listeners have not, you
for
know...
For me, the Cachalón, it's very... The way I... At least the way I vinify it and I treat it.
Only the way
I do it. I think it's kind of a combination or something in between a Gamay and a Grenache.
Okay.
And in the warmest...
Two great grapes.
In the warmest could be a, you know, southern area Grenache. In the cooler years could be more a Gamay style. It's a variety that have this pretty fruity, but also this foxy character of those varieties of Gamay and Grenache.
Interesting.
A good tannic structure, especially because it's planted in Douro, but not as prominent as all the other varieties in Douro. That makes the wine a bit rounder. And I divide the varietals in two main groups. You have the oxidative, the red varieties, oxidative, and the reductive varietals. So in the oxidative varietals would be Pinot Noir, Grenache, Gamay, you have others. And on the reductive would be Syrah and some of the Cabernets. And they have different reactions to the oxygen. And for me, the Castellón, it's much more near this group of oxidative varietals. A more fragile fruit that you need to protect with less structure that also protects less against the oxygen.
Sounds a little like Pinot Noir.
Have nothing to do, but I would put it in the same family. The same thing as again, it's much more rustic than Pinot.
Right.
It doesn't have the same elegance. It's a bigger berry, bigger cluster.
You know, we didn't talk about in the Tintos because we just talked about the Mano C, the Castelao. In the Tintos, you're working with a dozen varieties. I mean, like you said, there's 150, 70 plus, but you're working with what, a dozen or so? And why is that?
Because the vineyards
you
work,
a few dozen. The vineyards you work, that's what's there. The vineyards you've selected, you know, older vines, maybe a little higher.
Again, my unit is a parcel. It's not the varietal.
Right. So within those parcels.
And within those parcels, you can easily, if it is an old vine, co-planted, you can easily
multiple.
Have 10 different varietals co-planted. But meaning that you can have one that have just a few plants. One varietal can be only 3% of all the plants or less than that. And that's what makes the things interesting, because if you think, and that's when you really, what makes you think it's, what really makes a difference in this parcel to have a few plants of this variety? Does that influence the final wine? Yes or no?
It's something that
you... You don't have time to find out, because the only way to find out is one year you take that variety out and you do it out, and the other year you put it in. But the number of combinations are innumerous. It's, you know, it's a never-ending story. You can be trying and trying to see what is the different varietal. So when you go to a vineyard that you don't know, you look for the plants that are in bigger percentage. And then you know more or less how the vines are going to think. So it's,
you figure some things out. Are those, so in a parcel, it's about the parcel. Are those blended together? You're not.
We harvest everything at the same time.
Right. They are hard co-planted to separate with a couple dozen varietals.
Yeah, it's even difficult to do it.
But when you look at the plot, you know that in this particular plot, the predominant grapes, Torriga. And you know that there's very little of some interesting.
You have a little of something, and then eventually you find some that you really don't know what it is exactly. You look at it, but you have your doubts.
Right. All right. So is there anything we missed in the Douro? I think we got them.
Well, I tell you. For sure, we missed a lot of things in Douro, because Douro is 45,000 hectares of vineyards with all those varietals.
But I meant with you, you know, the wines you're making. We talked that, listen, you and I could talk about any one subject for 2 hours. You know, we're trying to be broader. I'll end with Vino Verde, but let's move into the Douro. You make a Mano
A, Alfrocheiro,
which is the grape, right?
The grape, yes.
I got to ask you a dumb question, and I forgot. Is that a white or a red grape?
A red.
It's a red grape. So it's Mano A Alfrocheiro in the Douro. Is that the only wine you're making in the Douro now?
No, I also do another Granito Cru, the same name as the Vinho Verde, just because the soil is granite. But it's a single parcel with three different varietals.
Ah.
And in this case, that's a very interesting story on the white wine. In this case, the varietals are planted separate in the same parcel. I could harvest separately.
You mean like rows?
Yeah, different rows.
They're not harvest, growing.
They're not growing together. But
do
we
you?
Harvest? But we harvest everything in the same day. So I'm doing the same thing in that my parcel is my unit, even if the varieties are separately planted.
That's interesting. That's interesting. So not to move too quickly off of that, but let's talk about Vino Verde, which you told me earlier, you know, has been a project you've been doing, you know, since you've been your own winemaker, winery. You are, I guess, in your mind and probably in reality, a special place. It's, what is it, Moncao and Melaco?
Melgaso, yep.
I think you've said this is the best place to grow.
In Portugal, this is the
in
place.
Portugal.
In Portugal, this is the place
why?
Known for the Alvarinho. Because, you know, the plant just survive and give the best wines there, in my opinion. Then you also have the Galician part that have plenty of Alvarinho with different characteristics that also do it very well.
Right.
But in all Portugal, and this is a great varietal, and people are planting all over, even Bordeaux now is planting officially. So it's a great varietal, but you can do very good wines. But in my opinion, it is my opinion, they are never as greater as when they are planted there.
That says
why? Maybe because you have a lot of humidity. Alvarinho likes to grow a lot. People do a more extensive vegetation, viticulture. I use descendant cordon. One vineyard grows 2.5-3 meters. It's growing high. The vegetation comes down. Combination that with heat, sun, but a lot of humidity. It's the combination of everything.
Right.
The soils.
It's just the perfect combination.
Exactly.
Well, you mentioned Vino Verde in Galicia. Do they have moisture problems up there too? Or
also.
Same thing.
Yeah, same.
The weather is very similar. It is similar.
Similar.
So you make one Vino Verde?
Only that one.
Right.
Yeah, and in this case, we already have, I would say, more or less 3.5 hectares there that we take care of. And
so
we use it.
You brought that up. You're controlling, what, 8 hectares, or has that grown through the years?
No, it's a bit more. It's kind of a bit more than 10, around 10.
Okay,
hectares.
So you... In
all the regions. In all
but
the regions
you just
together.
Mentioned the Vino Verde is like a third of the hectares. You just
No, the Vino Verde, it's our own production, always.
Right.
Always been, you know, the vineyards that we take care of.
Right. So you don't own the vineyards.
I don't own the vineyards.
I don't know what the right term is. Rent?
Rent. I rent the vineyards.
You know, consign, whatever. Do you have full control, it sounds like?
No, on the vineyards that we rent, we have full control. We are responsible to take the care of
you take them all. You know, they're not saying, tell me what to do.
No, we hire people to do that.
What, doesn't everyone aspire to own their own vineyards?
Of course, me too.
Is it cost, availability?
Cost.
It's mostly cost?
Cost and finding the right place.
Have prices gone up substantially then? Do you kick yourself and say, I should have bought it then because now it's worth more, or not
no,
that easy?
I didn't have the money then. I don't
right.
have much money
it's
now.
Irrelevant.
So it's
irrelevant.
Even if you find the right place, you have to, you know, go to the bank and ask how much money can I have to buy the specific vineyard.
Yeah.
But that's the next step. And I would say that now.
But renting a house and owning a house, you always want to own it. I'm guessing it's the same thing with your vineyards.
Of course it is.
But what compromise are you? Nobody's telling you to do it differently than you want. You know, you'd have.
You don't do the same kind of work. And it's more than that.
Pride of ownership?
It's not pride of ownership. It's you don't know if that vineyard is going to stay with you forever, number one.
You don't have that security.
You don't have
the guy may sell it to a developer and put a shopping mall there.
And then it's kind of, I'm doing, as you see, I'm doing a million things at the same time, meaning what I need is to have surface enough to build my own viticulture team to do the good job the way I wanted. So this is where the project can develop now. It's let's get our own vineyards. Let's get a team. It's getting really difficult to find people to work the vineyards and to know how to work the vineyards. So what you want now is to have size enough to have your own people working the vineyards and not hiring contractors that bring person that doesn't do, it does a job, but it's not exactly the way you do it. And for that, you need to have dimension. You need to have size. And to have size, you need to have money. And it's, what I've done, what I started the project...
It's tough.
What I tell to everyone that starts a wine project, normally, or you have a lot of money and you plant vineyards and you build a winery, I think everyone should start the other way around. You start by selling the wines. Then you produce the wines. Then you get the winery. Then you get the vineyards.
I think you may be right.
Well, if you don't have any money. If you have plenty of money, yeah, okay, you can do whatever you want.
And it's funny. There are amazing winemakers that don't have a lot of money. And then there are guys that have so much money, and it, nothing reflects anything. It's really, you know, how you think about it.
It's a way to start.
We have to move along. I want to do two things. I have this thing called the wine list. I want to ask you a bunch of questions, and then I want to taste your wine. There's nothing more enjoyable to me than sitting with a winemaker and tasting their wines. It's an opportunity for people to understand what it is, what's in front of us. And also, let's sell a little wine if we can, type thing. But I want to ask you two other questions. What's next for you? Like, I visited Portugal years ago. I was in Alentejo. I'm like, this place is crazy. Do you have an itch to go there? It doesn't make sense.
Well, I'm trying to pace myself, not to complicate my life.
Okay.
I already did it because I already had a small consultancy and doing a small wine.
So you got your...
In Spain, I love Bairrada. I hope I don't see any good vineyard because then I'm going to complicate even more my life.
So you need to focus.
In terms of wine production, I need to focus on what I have.
And right. As
you realize, we don't have that many labels compared with people now just bringing one more and
we,
one more.
We talked
and
about
more.
It.
And I'm avoiding doing more labels. And it's interesting what you find in people. I learned that when I was used to work at Newport. And now I don't know how many labels, millions of labels.
Right.
And we already had a lot of labels. And people realized that, come on, you have so many labels. It's so difficult to taste. But they always made the question, what's new? You just said I have too many labels.
Right,
what's
right.
new? There's nothing new. It's new so, is the new vintage.
It's so counter.
Yeah.
Last thing. Are you a big jazz fan?
Yeah, very much.
So I'm always curious, who have you followed? Who do you love? I mean, who are the best jazz? If you ask me, I'll say Coltrane, Miles Davis.
Miles for sure.
Miles from day one to now.
Miles is
just his whole evolution of.
No. I don't agree with the whole evolution. I think
you like the middle, earlier mainstream stuff.
Yeah, the mainstream one.
That stuff was off the charts too.
Yes,
the best musician.
But you know what? It's a bit like the wines. Simplicity. It's the most difficult thing to achieve in life. To do simple things.
So
when you do simple, you get perfection.
So to that point, there was a famous recording engineer, Rudy Van Gelder, whose whole concept
was
simple miking and, you know, not blowing it up. And it there is a parallel, you know. It's funny that you brought that up. All right, Luis, we have to do two things. One, we should open the wine. I have this old-fashioned corkscrew. You could do it. But I have a thing called the wine list. It's five questions. It's the same five questions I've asked. I've 300 guests.
Okay.
I post these on social media. All right. So the first question is, what are you drinking now? Meaning at your leisure, what's in your refrigerator with the seasons changing? Sometimes when you're on the road like now, you know, it's a chance for you. Tell me, sometimes the answer is beer. What are you drinking now besides?
I drink wine.
Are you curious about tasting it? Tell me a few things that you're drinking now.
I'm very classic. First, I drink a lot of everything.
Okay.
And I try to drink everything that I don't know. So if you tell me...
On purpose.
A varietal, a country, a region that I never tasted before, please, give me to taste.
Okay.
That's rule number one.
So that's inquisitive. Always trying, you know, anything.
Always trying. That's the first thing. Then, I used to get together with friends and... The friends would bring only reds. I was bringing whites. On purpose, because I like whites and reds. Nowadays, it's the opposite. They all bring whites, and I bring the reds.
Ah, that's
because,
funny.
Because, you know, I like the idea of having the ability to drink champagne, bubbles, whites, reds, fortified desserts, wines. This is the part of the wine that I like.
That's not an easy corkscrew, right?
No, it's not an easy cork.
Oh, is that it?
No.
All right, so you mentioned champagne in there. You mentioned all kinds of whites. There's that beautiful pop. So you're pretty inquisitive. You want to try everything.
I want to try everything, and I want to understand everything.
Right. All right, so that's a good answer. This is kind of the silliest question in the batch, but it's a fun one. What is your favorite wine and food pairing? Not what you and I think is the best ever, champagne and oysters. And it's probably something you don't eat often, but what works? And you've had it, you know, more than a few times. You know, what's like that, ooh, ah, wow, this goes great with that.
Jura non ouillé.
Wait, Jura?
Jura non, meaning not top up with a veil.
Oh, okay.
Oxidative with a veil.
So, okay.
Biological aging. So a veil, oxidation.
Wait, you're saying with a veil?
With a veil.
Okay, a veil. Oxidation.
Oxidation. And then you have two of the best things. Fat or ham or a great fry fish.
Because of the fried, the oil.
Exactly.
So the oxidative, it's...
Oxidative,
I don't think the word...
with acidity...
But what wine is that? Is that any wine that's made that way? What are you alluding to?
Jura and Sherry, they are the typical regions where the veil, and you know, this is where the yeast that produced that veil, it's part of the terroir.
Right.
And it's all about also the way you make it, not only the vineyards.
All right. So that's a first for the show. Nobody's ever given me that answer. But it makes total sense. I get it.
I advise everyone to visit Sherry. And to go with the locals at 10 o'clock in the morning, drinking manzanilla and fried fish.
There you go. The best thing ever. All right. So that's a good answer. And like I said, I post them. This is a question because you travel and, you know, you're in a specific region. I'm always curious about, like, your favorite wine restaurants and or bars. And I don't want you to feel like you're leaving friends out of the list or not. But what are places... either around where you live and work or something that's caught your mind when you travel, that just great wine selection, the people have great knowledge, the vibe is great.
Well, I have a huge list. This is part of my life doing investigation of the good wine places.
All right.
But I would say in Porto, for sure, you have to visit Prova.
Spell.
P-R-O-V-A. Prova means taste.
Okay. Is that wine and food?
Good wine, no food. Good wines, good jazz.
Okay, good combo.
In Montpellier, you have to visit Glou Glou.
G-L-O-U?
G-L-O-U.
G-L-O-U, Glou,
yeah.
Okay.
Great place, great vibes. They got to know me because of the amount of wines I drink.
Okay, you caught their attention.
Yes.
Yeah.
And there was a magic restaurant that don't exist anymore that all the wine producers know, or if they don't know, they should know.
What was
it? And unfortunately, it's Pot de Thym, outside Chablis, outside Auxerre.
Spell it.
Pot, P-O-T-E. It's a kind of a pot where you cook. De Thym. E-T-A-I-N.
Pot de Thym. Not there anymore?
The owner passed away a few years ago. The kids didn't keep the restaurant. They sold everything.
Sad.
It was the last place where you can go and drink a great old Burgundy for a fair price.
Gone.
That was magic.
Gone. Do you, because you're in New York, and I know based on what you told me, you take advantage of being here, try things. Is there anything in New York that pops up?
Oh, so many.
You want to name a couple?
It's a huge, Aldo, that is
Aldo Somme. Aldo Somme, my
friend.
He's been on the show.
That's
he's a different.
That's a great. That's a great place.
You're right about that.
I'm thinking about all the restaurants of Atomix Group. Jonelle is a big
sweetheart.
Supporter, and he's
It's
an interesting way how you put the wines. Treat it. It's just wine. You know, we're not saving lives. It's just wine. And sometimes people make it too difficult, too complicated, or too snob.
I agree.
We're just talking about wine.
Jonelle came on the show, and you know, I ask sommeliers to bring wine that reflects either the wine program or their taste or both. I swear he brought a Shisto. It makes sense.
Yeah,
you
no,
know, now that I
no,
know.
No, but it's,
so those are those. You don't have to go any further. Those are
many,
but those are very representative of the people, the place, the food.
Exactly.
Great choices.
And right. In two cases, they both turn the wine into simple things.
Yes,
you know,
both of them. Is knowledgeable.
They're knowledgeable,
as,
but they don't
as Aldo
fuss about
is,
it, yeah.
He's not fussy. I agree. All right, here's the fourth question. The fourth question is, what's your favorite all-time wine? When I asked that question, I was curious about what's like the rarest, most expensive wine you ever tasted. I don't care about that. In your lifetime in wine, what is that wine that was transcendental, that was important to you, that changed the way you thought? Do you remember a time and a wine, or more than one, where...
The thing is, this is a common question that everyone makes. What was the best or the more expensive?
Also, but that, people, I don't want that. I want, you know, what's an important wine to you?
I don't have one, you know. I don't have this epiphany wine that showed me life. I have many of them. And I'm talking...
Around the world?
17th century Madeiras.
Okay.
18th century Bordeaux. I'm talking about 78 Latache. I'm talking about, you know, there are few moments. 70 Montrachet.
Right, all of them.
Old Rieslings.
Have different reasons why. That's a fair answer.
Yeah.
Because those are not, some of them are rare, some are expensive, but they're important wines to you. They meant something.
1934 Gran Reserva Tondonia. An amazing wine.
Is it? for
It's wow. White truffles.
Is it
all the time?
Was it white truffles near release, or it evolved? Who knows?
I
right?
Know. Yeah, I was not there.
I just realized that was potentially the dumbest question I've asked in a week. All right, so that's a good answer. Nobody's answered it that way and mentioned specific eras and wines and different, you know, varieties and all. All right, this question is harder for winemakers, but I think Portugal as a country kind of addresses. Here's the question. Recommend to me the best wines for US dollars, $15, $20, $22, $25. Recommend a red and a white. You could do category, like Muscadet is pretty reasonable and it's not a bad. Well, and if you think you could stay in Portugal,
well, I could say in Portugal, I would say that in Portugal, the price would be much less than here.
Yes.
Because suddenly the wines arrive here and the price raises a lot. So on $15, maybe, I don't
or,
know what, to, what
or
to
20.
Tell you, but I would tell you a lot of 15 euro wines in Portugal, they are great to drink.
All right, that's still in the range.
So I would say probably, you know, trying to keep myself in Portugal, well, there's an interesting wine in Bairrada, very famous producer, that I always say, a long time I don't taste that wine, actually. And I always say, this is the best value. It's named Vinhas Velhas, and the producer is very famous, Luís Pato. This is one of the entry-level
wines. Wait,
spell
the name, so people...
Luís Pato, L-U-I-S-P-A-T-O.
Like oh, Luís Pato.
Pato.
Okay.
Yeah.
And you say it so quick and elegantly. Yeah. I don't.
And this is an entry level simple wine, although it's called old vines, but it's a very simple entry level wine. That whenever I taste, it's
but
always
that...
good. And his daughter too, Filipa Pato, she's a friend, and she also does this wine. Well, the Nossa, or the Dynamic, is kind of an entry level that you always have a pleasure when you open those bottles.
That's a perfect answer.
Simplicity, you know.
Now, red tends to be harder for people. Is it harder?
Red tends to be harder.
To get to that price point with good quality. Can you think of anything?
Well, I would say, I'm this one is on my own interest. I do a wine, but this is a producer that I consult.
That's fine.
That
I don't care.
That doesn't get here to States because it's only sold in one place in the world, in that wine bar.
What is it? Now you have my
interest. It's a varietal named Morisco. It is a bad variety planted in Douro. that we used to throw away or just regraft it with other ones. Big clusters, big berries, no color whatsoever. And this is kind of the glue wine. It's the wines that you drink easily. So this wine you can only drink in one place in the world, in this wine bar. You can only drink the bottle in Prova, the wine bar that I told you
before. Okay.
You can drink it only there. You have to buy the bottle there. You cannot take a bottle home. You have to open the bottle there, drink it everything there. You cannot buy it to take it home. And the other rule, it has to be the less expensive in the wine list. That's the rule I gave it to the wine.
Wow, I've never heard of a wine like that. That's interesting. I would assume it's popular in that circumstance.
More or less. So nowadays, I don't think it's fashionable to say that I'm selling the less expensive wine on the list. It's kind of people are running away from that.
Yeah, I don't, you know, although sometimes people look for it, but then people say, give me the second least expensive. Yeah. You know, there's that whole argument. All right, so good job on those questions. Like I said, I'm going to post them. Our listeners love to hear, you know, what guys like you were drinking and thinking and all that. All right, the last segment we do is we call it the weekly wine sip, where I taste a different wine every week from the maker or, you know, whoever I invite. This week we're going to taste Xisto Ilimitado. Okay.
Unlimited.
All right, so the floor is yours. Tell me about this wine before we taste it.
Well, this is the main variety here, Rebigat. It's what you have others, but this is really what makes the wine different. And this is a wine that tried to represent a certain area and a certain specific type of soil in that region that we call it mica schist. So this is a soil where the granite meets the schist. So it's the slate, but with the minerals of the granite. That for me,
so it's the two, best soil. It's actually the two interactions.
It's a transition soil. And for me, this is the best soils in the Douro to produce white wines. And it's not only me, because when I arrived there and many generations ago, people were already planting whites and not reds.
Okay.
So it's not me finding out that.
All right. So let's throw it over the tongue and evaluate it. But before that, color-wise, it's got a nice straw yellow. You know, it's not pale. It's not it's a pretty prominent.
Try not to protect the wines too much against the oxygen. So doing a wine is like raising a child. You should have two boundaries. In between the boundary, they can do whatever they want. If they try to get out, you just kick them in. So let the wine, let them run without their shoes outside.
Right.
They don't get as many colds when they go to school.
Give them a little freedom.
Give them freedom. So that's what I try to do in the wines. Actually, the wine is very simply that you press, you decant a little bit, not to have that many sediments. You put it in barrel and you forget it.
That's it.
They do malolactic in barrel. We don't control the temperature. We don't do batonnage. We add sulfur after malolactic. So it's kind of easy going.
All right. So put it up to your nose and tell me some of the descriptors of this wine. And then the second question is, what's the Rabigato? You know, tell me about the nose in this wine.
Why do I love the varietal? Is because Rabigato is not imposing himself. It's like a person that doesn't shout. It speaks on a low tone. It's a great variety to show the place where it comes from.
But when you get your nose in it and it comes up, what's
when
coming?
For me, what it gives...
It's beautiful, but I suck at this, so you have to tell
discreet.
Me.
So for me, it gives minerality, whatever. We don't know what it is. So I advise everyone, wet the stone and smell the stone. That will be a kind of a smell that you could get it. White flowers.
I was waiting for you.
Some kind of flowers. And for me, have these citrus notes. And 22 have less than others. 22 was a warmer year. But more than the citrus fruit, it's like the leaf of the tree, not the fruit.
Right.
Green citrus kind of. And then you have, you know, the... what the French call vin de soleil, the sunshine. You feel the sunshine in the nose. You know, it's kind of warmness,
right?
Fennel notes. That's typical, and those wines get that with age.
It's beautiful. All right, let's. I want to get a feel on the mouthfeel. So, gorgeous mouthfeel, like medium, no thinness, but no fatness. I get it. Teeny bit of the acidity, which is nice, you know, right over the tongue. It's a beautiful mouthfeel. Now, on the palate, the things we discussed on the nose, are they replicated in the palate or other things kind of come up on the palate?
For me, the palate is, it's important how it presents from the beginning to the end. It's a single piece, you know, you don't get in the acidity first or in the end, or everything is get together like a string and comes up.
That's not an easy thing to describe, yeah. Not an easy thing to do.
No, but it's
where everything is integrated.
But you know why? Because people again are trying too much. Suddenly everyone wants acidity in the wines, and though it's a warm region, we can harvest very early. Unripe vineyard that's going to have a lot of acidity, but it's not going to have a lot of everything else.
Right.
And I think the main
thing
is
work.
Search for the higher vineyards, harvest a little bit later, when you can have all of that, plus more complexity and more things. So for me, many years, Portugal was doing... Actually, the history shows a lot of great wines with a lot of acidity, but in Douro especially, when they start by doing wines... Trend then, the white wines were new barrel, lees, batonnage. They were soup after 2 or 3 years.
All those things. Yeah.
People realized afterwards they need acidity. So they went up in acidity.
Right.
And then suddenly they are harvesting unripe grapes just to have the acidity. Wine is all about balance.
Right.
Sugar, there's no acidity, balance. Alcohol. It's
that
balance.
Effort creates no balance.
Yeah. So that's.
Am I getting. In a good way, some salinity.
That's typical of the Douro white.
Right, it's
reds.
In there in a a really terrific way. Not
a saltiness
too saline
kind of
that works
feeling.
So well with all the other elements of it.
Yeah.
All right, so this is the Xisto Ilimitado. This is the 22. It's a Vinho Branco, and the predominant grape is Rabigato. And that's available. You'll see it in restaurants and
be here in New York in many places.
Yeah, yeah. Your wines are available. Sometimes they're not the easiest to get, but that's because they're so good, they're so popular, and
it's not like
you make.
I don't
know
many bottles.
Yeah.
So.
All right, Luis, we have to wrap up. I want to do a quick wrap up, and then I want to get some information from you. So just hang in there for a second. If you have a question, suggestion, wine happening or event, hit me up at sam@thegrapenation.com. That's sam@thegrapenation.com. Subscribe to the Grape Nation podcast on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Spotify, Google Podcasts, wherever you get your pods. By subscribing, you'll get Luis's interview delivered to you. Leave a review if you like the podcast. Follow us on Instagram at SBenRuby, on Twitter at BenRuby. I know they're two different handles, but you can always use the hashtag TheGrapeNation to get to us on both. We are on Facebook at The Grape Nation. As I mentioned, we'll post Luis's wine list answers. He gave us some great suggestions. And I will post the weekly wine sip, the Xisto Ilimitado. Give you more information on that. Luis, if people want to find more out about your wines, what's the best place to go? Website or?
Well, not the website is done. It's a beautiful website that doesn't work because
no.
I should bring the job, but I forgot the website a long time ago. Actually, it's a beautiful photographer that put some picture that I was supposed to change each 6 months.
It's not working.
It's there for
well.
Five or more years, 6 years or seven. I think the best way it's.
Social
send me
media?
An email. Send me an email.
Okay.
It's the easiest way.
All right. What about social media? Do you use social media?
Instagram.
Do you do a winery and personal? Or
no,
you
no,
all
just winery. I don't have any social media.
So what is
it? Media.
Is it Luis?
El Ciabra Wine, I think. I'm very bad on social media too. I'm sorry.
You know what? While we're here, let's look it up because I want to give everyone. So it's El S-E-A.
Yeah. El Ciabra Wine.
Is there any? Yeah, all one word. No underscores.
Yeah, everything in one word.
So it's L-S-E-A-B-R-A wine. I think if you go there, you'll be up to date on everything. And you can go to the website. It'll
just
give you some
me.
Information.
You can also go there. Just
yeah,
send
you
it.
Could send him.
Yeah.
And, you know, if you go into any good restaurant in New York and some other big cities and you ask the Psalms about them, you'll probably excite them because they love the wines and they'll probably have them. All right. I want to thank my guest, Luis Ciabra. Luis, thank you for sitting down. Thank you to our engineer, Armin, and everyone at the Heritage Radio Network. I'm Sam Benrubi, and you've been listening to The Grape Nation. The Grape Nation is powered by Simplecast. Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. Keep in touch at heritageradionetwork.org/subscribe.
Hey, everybody, I'm Nick Layton.
And I'm Leah Bonema.
And we're the hosts of Were You Raised by Wolves?
Each week, we try to make the world a kinder, nicer place.
Well, that's the idea, at least.
I mean, we try.
Have you ever wondered what to do if you're ghosted?
Or what to do when a friend asks you to borrow money?
Or the proper way to eat Cheetos?
You know, the big questions.
So please find Were You Raised by Wolves wherever you listen.